Miami restaurants and bars opened in early May. Now those same establishments are closing their doors again. Governor Ron DeSantis is urging calm.
There's no need to be fearful.
But are Floridians taking the threat seriously enough?
I'm David Greene with Rachel Martin, and this is Up First from NPR News. Miami is not the only city shutting down to slow the virus. As more communities around the country are urged to stay home, analysts are warning economic recoveries might stall.
What's being captured here is the sugar high of a rushed reopening.
So what will it take to turn things around?
And with the economic future uncertain, President Trump has yet to articulate a clear plan for his second term. Instead, he's trying to foment a culture war around Confederate symbols and sports mascots. Does that strategy have a chance? Stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your day.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Moxtra, providing businesses with their own one-stop customer portal for today's digital age, delivering a one-stop experience for your customers to do business with you from anywhere, at any time. Learn more at moxtra.com.
Support also comes from BetterHelp, online counseling by licensed professional counselors specializing in isolation, depression, stress, and anxiety. Visit BetterHelp.com/upfirst to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Right now, Florida is flooded with the coronavirus. The state reopened early, but more than 11,000 Floridians tested positive for the virus on Saturday alone.
That's right. And young people have been a major factor here. Many in their 20s and 30s have few, if any, symptoms. And with clubs, bars, and restaurants open, they are contributing to this explosion of infections. Right now, hospitals across the state of Florida are feeling the impact.
So we've got NPR's Greg Allen with us this morning from Miami. Hi, Greg. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
What's going on? I mean, just how bad is the situation there?
Well, you know, while things were getting really bad in the Northeast, Florida stayed relatively flat in terms of the numbers. It took the state 3 months to register 100,000 cases of the coronavirus, but that was 2 weeks ago. Since then, the number of cases has doubled. We now have more than 206,000. For medical experts, more troubling than the number of cases, though, is the percentage of people who are testing positive. In Florida, it went from single digits a few weeks ago to around 15% now. Public health experts say that shows that cases are increasing not just because Florida is doing more tests, as some officials have said, but because a rising percentage of people, more and more people are becoming infected. At some hospitals in the state, ICUs are near capacity or at capacity in some cases. Overall, there is still adequate capacity, plus surge capacity, extra beds hospitals can bring online. But at Miami's largest hospital, Jackson Health, the CEO, Carlos Magoya, recently told officials in Miami-Dade County that staffing's the area he's most concerned about.
In the last 14 days, we have seen our numbers of patients in bed for COVID double.
Yesterday, the hospital had 345 patients who were positive for COVID-19. That's up from 150 last month. Jackson Health and many other hospitals in Florida have now suspended elective procedures for all but urgent or emergency cases.
Okay, so what is the governor's plan here? What's his response?
Well, you know, he did roll back a little bit last week. They closed all bars in the state, but he's really resisted taking stronger measures, as many people have been calling for, such as a statewide, you know, face covering mandate. On Monday, here's what he had to say.
There's no need to be fearful. Let's just focus on the facts. We understand what we've got to do as a state, and let's get it done.
What he says he's doing is they're focusing on the most vulnerable people, which are the elderly, especially people in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. Those people account for more than half of the fatalities in Florida and many other states as well. The state is also requiring some 200,000 workers of those facilities now to be tested for the coronavirus every 2 weeks. And as for the surge in cases among young people, DeSantis asked everyone just to keep it in perspective.
The number one age for cases in Florida is 21. And if you're 21 and you don't have significant comorbidities, your fatality rate is pretty much zero.
You know, the governor says he thinks Floridians are listening to the pleas from medical experts and officials that people should behave responsibly and avoid large gatherings. And as for the young people, he says he found it, quote, comforting that it's affecting an age group that's less likely to see big consequences. Although we should say that the health consequences from COVID-19 are still unknown, the long-term consequences.
So that's the state perspective. What about local governments? How are they responding?
Here in Miami-Dade County, the mayor, Carlos Jimenez, has announced he's closing restaurants, indoor dining. He's also closing Airbnbs, you know, short-term rentals, gyms, fitness centers. And also they have a late-night curfew, so they're taking steps at the local level.
Huh. All right, NPR's Greg Allen reporting from Miami. Thank you, Greg.
You're welcome.
So the U.S. economy is caught in this seemingly unbreakable cycle that is directly tied to the pandemic.
That's right. A state starts to see the virus recede, businesses open back up, the economy starts to get better, and then because people are out and about again, the virus comes back and the economy takes another plunge. Well, analysts from Goldman Sachs are warning that the economic gains from reopening could be in real jeopardy for June and July.
We've got NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley with us this morning. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Let's start with some good news. Why not? The NASDAQ hit another high yesterday. There was this news also that service-oriented businesses are seeing a pickup. What's happening?
Right. Last week, we learned manufacturing activity had picked up in June after shrinking in March, April, and May. And now we know the much larger services sector, that's everything from construction to coffee shops to chiropractors, is also bouncing back. And that June rebound was both faster and stronger than a lot of analysts had expected.
So why are they putting up these caution flags?
The fear is this comeback could be short-circuited by this sharp jump in coronavirus cases that we're seeing in many parts of the country. Economist Tim Quinlan, who is with Wells Fargo Securities, says if that were to happen, then this early June rebound would not look nearly so positive.
A skeptic might reasonably argue that what's being captured here is the sugar high of a rushed reopening.
With the typical crash that follows. Some states, as we know, are now pausing or even backtracking in their push to reopen. When the services sector survey was done last month, one respondent said, quote, "The economy seems to be on the road to recovery, but let's not get too complacent." Remember, COVID-19 is still a pandemic, and this person said you've got to be really careful and follow all the recommendations religiously if you want to run your business safely in this environment.
So how are businesses, individual consumers, how are they responding to the spike in new infections?
In hard-hit states, you can already see some decline in people's willingness to go out and spend money, and you can see a resulting drop in demand for workers. What looked like a pretty robust recovery for consumer spending in early June starts to stall out as the virus picks up speed. As a result, as you mentioned, the economists at Goldman Sachs have now lowered their forecast for economic growth in July and August.
Do they have any prescriptions?
Yeah, the investment bank's chief economist, Jan Hatzius, says we could keep the economy open and still keep a lid on infections if the government would simply order people across the country to wear face masks when they're out in public. Hatzius says that could cut the infection rate by more than 60% without the nearly $1 trillion price tag of a government lockdown.
Face masks are very effective in reducing virus spread. That would bring down the growth rate of confirmed virus cases significantly and reduce the need for what otherwise would be a significant hit to the economy.
It's certainly late, but Hatzius says it's not too late for a nationwide mask mandate. And he points to Texas Governor Greg Abbott's about face on this issue as a sign that, you know, policymakers can make changes here.
But the bottom line being the economy's not going to get better until the virus has abated. Finally, Scott, I've got to ask you, there are these reports that a lot of big businesses got small business loans as part of the recovery effort for the pandemic. What can you tell us?
Yeah, the federal government's made more than $500 billion in loans under the Paycheck Protection Program to keep businesses afloat. And yesterday, the Trump administration sort of grudgingly released the names of some of the companies that got bigger loans. And there are some surprises. Companies connected to wealthy people like Kanye West or Jim Justice, the governor of West Virginia, got loans. There's going to be some second guessing here. Like other elements of the government's relief program, there's a trade-off between trying to shovel money out the door quickly and being really targeted about where that money goes.
All right, NPR Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
Okay, as the country wrestles with surging outbreaks and economic uncertainty, President Donald Trump is leaning into a culture war.
Yeah, yesterday alone, the president criticized sports teams from Washington, D.C. and Cleveland for considering name changes. He demanded an apology from a black NASCAR driver who had done nothing wrong. And he said NASCAR's ratings were down because they banned the Confederate flag from their races. Actually, the ratings for NASCAR are up. The president is pretty clear here on where he stands in this national moment of racial reckoning. But how does all this fit into his strategy for re-election in November?
We're going to ask NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Hi, Tam.
Good morning.
So incumbent presidents usually try to broaden their base with a message that attempts to bring more people into their tent. President Trump appears to be doing the opposite. Yeah, President Trump has had a hard time recently articulating an affirmative pitch for his reelection. It basically comes down to a second term agenda of make America great again, as Vice President Pence recently said. You know, President Trump had planned to run on the strength of the economy, but the pandemic blew a hole in that, and his handling of the coronavirus response is not polling well either. So he has returned to themes that he used during his first run for office, racial resentment, grievance, and really trying to set up this battle for the soul of America. Essentially, as one person put it to me, running against other Americans.
You've been talking to some pollsters about this. What are they seeing? Is there an appetite out there for this kind of messaging?
Well, the problem for President Trump, they say, is that this messaging doesn't match the mood of the moment. I talked to Christine Matthews. She's a Republican pollster who has been critical of President Trump. And she's spent a lot of time in recent years talking to suburban women, doing focus groups with suburban women. And she told me there is no polling to suggest that the president's strategy here is a good idea.
They think somehow that there are suburban women, you know, living in fear of these angry mobs taking down these statues, and that's the direction to go. So when the polls don't reflect that, the campaign has decided to say to themselves, well, people are lying to the pollsters.
The president calls it the silent majority. In fact, Matthew says suburban women support the Black Lives Matter movement, not all of them, but the majority.
So that's suburban women. I mean, is there any evidence out there about whether this strategy is working for President Trump with any constituency?
Well, certainly with some constituency, with his base, it is working, but his base is not enough to reelect him. Polls show former Vice President Joe Biden is way ahead, including in key swing states. President is set to hold another rally on Saturday in New Hampshire. It will be outdoors, and they are strongly encouraging supporters to wear masks. That's a change from the last one. We'll see if the president recalibrates his messages at all as well.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith for us this morning. Tamara, thank you.
You're welcome.
And that is up first for this Tuesday, July 7th. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. Come back here tomorrow. We'll be here. And we know that the news does not stop when this podcast stops. So follow us on Twitter. We're at UpFirst. We'll give you a daily roundup of all the most important stories of the day.
We appreciate that you wake up with NPR. Your NPR station makes UpFirst possible each and every morning. Support them and support us at donate.npr.org/UpFirst.
These days, Chelsea Handler tries to keep her and her friend's white privilege in check.
She starts like really getting weepy. And I was like, well, what are you doing right now? You just said you read White Fragility. You cannot talk about reading White Fragility and start to cry.
Comedian Chelsea Handler on white privilege and a new book. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.